Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a journey into social contract theory. Think of it for you as a way to understand the foundational agreements that, well, underpin how we organize ourselves in society.
Right.
It's about the rules, sometimes written, often unwritten, that we collectively abide by in the hope of achieving a more peaceful, harmonious, productive, happy, and ultimately more satisfying life together.
Mm-hmm.
It really gets to the heart of our shared moral obligations and the very structure of our societies.
That's right. And what's so fascinating for you is that at its core, social contract theory asks a fundamental question. Why do we have these rules? And perhaps more importantly, why should you, as an individual within this society, follow them?
Hmm.
The theory suggests that society, government, and the moral duties we feel are all rooted in a kind of agreement, a contract, if you will, among individuals. In this deep dive, we've brought together some of the most influential philosophical perspectives on this idea to really dig into how this contract explains the societies you live in and the role you play within them.
And we've got a truly insightful lineup of thinkers for you to consider. We'll be exploring the groundbreaking ideas of three key figures who've shaped social contract theory in profound ways. Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and John Rawls. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with a thinker whose life was marked by upheaval, Thomas Hobbes.
A dramatic entry into the world, indeed. Born in 1588, a time when the Spanish Armada loomed large, Hobbes lived through considerable political turmoil, and it's, well, quite likely those experiences colored his philosophical lens.
Yeah, you think so.
His most famous work, Leviathan, published in 1651, presents a really powerful argument for the necessity of social order. You might find the frontispiece, that's the illustration on the title page, particularly telling. It depicts this massive sovereign figure, and if you look closely, you'll see it's actually composed of countless smaller individuals all coming together to form this larger entity.
That's exactly. For you, that image really encapsulates the central idea. Individual wills merging to create a single governing power. Hobbes starts by asking you to imagine a scenario where there is no government, no overarching laws. He calls this the state of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this isn't necessarily about some historical period, but more of a thought experiment for you to consider. What would human interaction be like at its most fundamental level without any established authority?
And Hobbes paints a rather bleak picture for you in the state of nature. Without a common power to enforce rules, he believed individuals would primarily be driven by their own self-interest and a pervasive fear of others.
Right.
Because resources are limited and fundamentally everyone possesses a roughly equal capacity for violence, this would inevitably descend into what he called a condition of war. This doesn't necessarily mean constant open warfare, but rather a persistent state of insecurity where the threat of conflict always hangs in the air, making any kind of stable, productive life virtually impossible for you.
Right. As Hobbes famously described it, life in that state would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short.
Not exactly the kind of existence any of us would aspire to, right?
Not at all.
For you, it means constantly being on guard, focused solely on your own survival in a world where everyone else is operating under the same relentless drive. It's a pretty pessimistic outlook, and it really makes you think about the foundations of security.
It is. But within this rather pessimistic view, Hobbes does identify what he considers fundamental natural rights. For you, the most crucial of these is the liberty of self-preservation, the inherent right to do whatever is necessary to protect your own life.
Okay.
Corresponding to this right, he posits a law of nature, which is essentially a kind of moral imperative for you to preserve your own life and, as much as possible, avoid actions that would lead to its destruction. It's interesting for you to note, though, as our source material points out, the justification for this law of nature in Hobbes' philosophy isn't entirely clear-cut. He appeals to our rationality, suggesting it's in our self-interest to follow it. But it might leave you wondering about a deeper, more inherent basis for this fundamental duty not to harm others.
That's a valid point for you to consider, definitely. Nevertheless, Hobbes uses this framework to argue for what he sees as the only rational way out of the horrors of the state of nature.
Which is?
He believed that individuals would collectively choose to transfer their rights to a sovereign power. This could be a single person, like a monarch, or a small group, in exchange for the promise of protection and, crucially, the preservation of their own freedom to survive.
So for you, it boils down to a trade-off, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We give up some of our individual liberty to act entirely as we please in return for the security that comes with a governing authority.
Okay.
It's similar to that analogy we looked at. You might give up the freedom to drive at dangerously high speeds for the greater security that comes from everyone else adhering to speed limits.
Precisely. By surrendering certain freedoms to an all-powerful sovereign, individuals, including you, gain the security and stability necessary to pursue your goals and live without that constant underlying fear. This sovereign would then establish and enforce laws with significant consequences for those who break them, effectively deterring the kind of chaos that defines the state of nature he describes for you.
And Hobbes really emphasized the idea of absolute sovereignty. Once the people, including you, have transferred those rights, they can't really take them back?
Nope.
This is an aspect that makes some scholars, when they consider Hobbes, a little suspicious of his underlying motives, especially given his clear support for the monarchy of his time. It probes you to think about whether his primary aim was truly to describe a fundamental aspect of human nature, or perhaps to, justify the existing political order.
That's a fair question for you to keep in mind. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, let's shift gears and consider a very different perspective on the social contract offered by John Locke. Writing a bit later, Locke, with his influential two treatises on civil government, particularly the second treatise published in 1690, had a profound impact, as you know, on the development of democratic thought.
Absolutely. For you, the influence of Locke is undeniable. Our own Declaration of Independence reads almost like a love letter to his ideas.
It really does.
He also starts with this concept of a state of nature, natural rights, and natural laws. But the conclusions he draws for you are strikingly different from those of Hobbes.
Indeed. Locke identifies natural rights as life, liberty, and property, a trio that Jefferson, as you'll recall, famously adapted to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration.
Right, right.
Locke also posited a fundamental law of nature, which for you is the duty not to harm others in their life, health, liberty, or possessions. So, you see, there is a built-in moral framework within Locke's state of nature that is considerably less bleak than the one Hobbes envisioned for you.
Okay, so a bit more optimistic, maybe. But Locke, like Hobbes, recognizes for you the need for a social contract to protect these inherent rights and prevent society from descending into chaos. However, the crucial distinction, the point where he fundamentally diverges from Hobbes, is his strong emphasis on the consent of the governed.
Yes, that's the key.
This is where he truly breaks away from the idea of absolute sovereignty that Hobbes championed.
Exactly. For Locke, legitimate government derives its authority entirely from the consent of the people it governs. That's you and everyone else in society. The people, in Locke's view, rule indirectly through elected representatives at various levels of government. You participate by voting people into office, and equally importantly, you have the power to vote them out if they fail to represent your interests or uphold your rights. This idea of popular sovereignty is absolutely central to Locke's theory for you.
And even if you haven't explicitly signed a formal social contract, Locke introduces this important idea of tacit consent.
Yes, tacit consent.
Just by living in a country, enjoying its protections and benefits, using its roads, accessing its services, you implicitly agree to abide by its laws. It's akin to choosing to continue playing a game, even if you weren't the one who initially established the rules.
That's a clear way for you to understand it. And this consent, in Locke's view, is not unconditional. He argues for a right of revolt or revolution.
Okay, this is huge.
If the government fails to uphold its end of the social contract by actively violating the people's natural rights, your rights, then the people have the moral right to resist and even overthrow that oppressive government. In Locke's framework, such tyrannical actions essentially dissolve the social contract, returning the people to that original state of nature.
This connects so directly for you to the American Revolution. The colonists felt that the British crown was fundamentally violating their natural rights through actions like taxation without representation, the forced quartering of soldiers in their homes, and a general disrespect for their property.
Exactly. They saw it as a clear breach.
They viewed these actions as a clear breach of the social contract, thereby justifying their decision to revolt against British rule.
Precisely. The Declaration of Independence itself lays out these specific grievances as compelling evidence that the British government had become destructive of the very purposes for which governments are established, thus explicitly invoking the right of the people to alter or abolish it. This, of course, raises a timeless and complex question for you to consider. Under what specific circumstances, if any, is a revolutionary war truly just? It brings into play intricate considerations of just war theory versus pacifism, and it compels you to critically examine the moral underpinnings of the American Revolutionary War itself.
A profoundly important question for you to reflect on. Okay, let's now turn our attention to our final social contract theorist, John Rawls, who brings a more contemporary and, in some ways, quite different perspective to this enduring debate.
Mm-hmm.
Rawls, his seminal work, A Theory of Justice, published in 1971, is widely regarded as a landmark achievement and significantly revitalized social contract theory in the 20th century for you.
Rawls adopts a rather different methodological approach for you. Instead of focusing on a historical or even a hypothetical state of nature as his starting point, he introduces a fascinating thought experiment known as the veil of ignorance to help determine the most just principles for organizing a society.
So for you to understand this better, tell us more about this veil of ignorance. It sounds quite intriguing.
It is, yeah. Imagine for a moment that you and others are brought together to decide on the fundamental principles that will govern your society. Now, here's the crucial element for you. Behind this metaphorical veil of ignorance, you and everyone else are temporarily stripped of any knowledge about your own particular characteristics, your race, your gender, your age, your inherent abilities or talents, your social standing, even your deeply held values and beliefs.
Oh, okay.
You have no idea who you will be in the society whose rules you are helping to create.
Okay, for you, I can see the logic unfolding here. By deliberately removing this knowledge of our own specific circumstances and potential advantages or disadvantages, we are prevented from choosing principles that would unfairly benefit us or disadvantage others once the veil is lifted and we rejoin society.
Exactly.
It's a really clever way to try and ensure impartiality and fairness in the selection of societal rules for everyone, isn't it?
Exactly. Rawls argues that this thought experiment would lead individuals, including you, to agree on two fundamental principles of justice. The first of these is the principle of equal liberty, which essentially states that everyone should have an equal right to the most extensive set of basic liberties that is compatible with everyone else having the same degree of liberty.
Right.
You can think of it like everyone having the freedom to swing their arms as long as your swing doesn't connect with someone else's nose.
That analogy really helps you visualize it.
Yeah.
Maximizing individual freedom while simultaneously ensuring it doesn't encroach upon the freedom of others. And what, for you, is the second principle that Rawls posits?
The second principle is known as the difference principle. This principle addresses the inevitable social and economic inequalities that Rawls acknowledges will likely exist in any complex society. However, the difference principle stipulates that these inequalities should be structured in such a way that they are both, one, reasonably expected to be to everyone's advantage, and two, attached to positions and offices that are open to all under conditions of fair equality of opportunity.
Let's break that down for you. The first part suggests that even those who are least advantaged in society should ultimately benefit from any existing inequalities.
Right.
That example of the highly skilled neurosurgeon, like Ben Carson, who earns a significant income due to their socially valuable skills that ultimately improve the lives of many, comes to mind from our sources.
Mm-hmm.
But it also prompts you to consider, as our sources do, the debate around things like the extraordinarily high salaries of some athletes and entertainers. Does that truly benefit everyone, particularly the least advantaged, in the same direct way?
Those are precisely the kinds of critical considerations Rawls' difference principle is designed to spark for you. It compels you to think deeply about what kinds of inequalities are justifiable within a just society and how those inequalities contribute to the overall well-being of everyone, especially those at the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder.
Yeah.
The second part of the principle, emphasizing that positions of advantage should be open to all, underscores the fundamental importance of equal opportunity. Everyone should, in principle, have a fair and equitable chance to attain those more privileged positions in society. Though, as our sources also point out for you, the extent to which this ideal is actually attainable in the real world is certainly a subject of ongoing debate and concern.
So, Rawls, much like Hobbes and Locke before him, ultimately envisions a social contract for you. A theoretical agreement on these fundamental principles of justice that would then serve as the guiding framework for the structure of a just society. Now that we've explored these three major perspectives on social contract theory, let's take a step back and consider some of the broader strengths and inherent weaknesses of this entire approach for you.
Certainly. One of the significant strengths for you is the theory's capacity to provide seemingly straightforward and plausible answers to some of the most fundamental questions about how individuals should coexist within a society.
Right.
It offers a framework for establishing moral and political rules that can be appealing, especially in a diverse society where individuals hold a wide range of values and beliefs.
Right. For you, it offers a way to understand morality and social order as emerging from a process of agreement. which can be particularly compelling in a world where people hold such differing viewpoints on ethical matters. Mm-hmm. And the underlying idea that everyone within a society is, at least in theory, a party to this social contract is also a notable strength for you to consider.
Absolutely. Furthermore, as our sources highlight for you, social contract theory resonates with the insights of the well-known prisoner's dilemma. It underscores the crucial understanding that by willingly sacrificing some immediate individual self-interest and adhering to a set of mutually agreed-upon rules, you and everyone else in society can ultimately achieve better overall outcomes and a more stable, cooperative environment in the long run.
So it's that central idea for you that sometimes choosing to cooperate and abide by established rules, even when it might seem a bit inconvenient or restrictive in the short term, can lead to a more secure, stable, and ultimately more beneficial long-term situation for everyone involved.
Precisely.
But, as is the case with any theoretical framework, there are also inherent weaknesses and limitations for you to consider.
Definitely. One significant challenge for you is the reliance on these potentially unreliable thought experiments, such as Hobbes' State of Nature or Rawls' Veil of Ignorance.
Right.
Your own intuitions and assumptions about what life might truly be like in a pre-governance scenario, or what principles you would actually choose from behind a veil of ignorance, might differ significantly from those posited by the theorists.
That's a crucial point for you. These are, after all, hypothetical scenarios, and it's inherently difficult to definitively say what conclusions would naturally and universally follow from them.
Yeah, very true.
And our sources also raise a pertinent question for you. Are the rights and duties that emerge from a social contract truly deeply moral in nature, or are they perhaps more akin to artificial, politically constructed rules that could potentially be changed or discarded?
Exactly. There's a legitimate concern for you that social contract theory might inadvertently reduce morality to a form of pragmatic agreement rather than grounding it in something more fundamental, objective, or universally binding. And finally, it's important for you to recognize that the mere fact that there might be widespread agreement on certain principles within a society doesn't automatically guarantee that those principles are inherently just or morally sound.
A really critical point for you to take away, especially when we consider Rawls' theory. Even if it were true that everyone behind the veil of ignorance would indeed choose his two principles of justice, does that automatically mean those principles are the most ethically just?
Right. Does it follow?
Just because a particular set of rules might gain popular acceptance doesn't necessarily equate to them being morally right or fair in a deeper sense.
Precisely. There's a potential logical gap there for you, assuming that popular choice equates directly to inherent justice. So while social contract theory has undeniably been incredibly influential and offers a practical framework for thinking about political organization, it does face some significant philosophical challenges when it comes to providing a completely robust grounding for our deepest moral obligations and universal rights for you.
So, to bring it all together for you, this deep dive into social contract theory reveals it to be a historically significant, intellectually ingenious, and, well, undeniably practical way of thinking about how societies are structured, particularly when viewed from a political standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
The core idea of individuals collectively trading certain freedoms for the sake of greater security and the overall collective good through an agreed-upon framework has profoundly shaped the development of our political systems and continues to influence how we think about governance.
Indeed. From Hobbes' compelling argument for a strong sovereign power to Locke's enduring emphasis on the consent of the governed and the right of revolution in the face of tyranny, and Rawls' a thought-provoking veil of ignorance as a tool for achieving a more just society, these theories offer invaluable insights for you into the foundational principles that underpin our social and political lives.
But this leads us to a final thought-provoking question for you to really consider. While social contract theory provides a useful lens for understanding political organization and the creation of constitutions, does it truly capture the full essence of our deepest moral duties and the universal rights we believe all individuals possess?
That's the big question, isn't it?
Is it possible that there's a need for other ethical frameworks, perhaps ones that delve deeper into our shared humanity and intrinsic moral value, to address these more fundamental questions, to go beyond a purely contractual basis for understanding morality? It's something truly important for you to ponder as you navigate the complexities of the society you live in and the moral obligations you feel. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.